Thank you for having me.
I'm thinking back to 1964, Lyndon Johnson's declared war on poverty, and that was certainly targeting urban areas. Is this a slow evolution since that time, or has it been accelerated of late?
It's been a shift towards the suburbs over quite some period of time. But the 2000s were remarkable for the rapid uptick in poverty. Both the magnitude and the pace of growth that we saw really stood out. And it's actually the decade in which we, for the first time, crossed a tipping point, where now there are more poor residents living in the suburbs of our major metro areas than the big cities that anchor those regions.
Is it a zero-sum game whereby we should consider poverty to be diminished in urban areas, or does it speak to a more impoverished nation at large relative to 10 or 20 years ago?
Well, we do have more poor residents, more people living under the federal poverty line today than we did 20 years ago. And it's not a zero-sum game. You know, at the same time we've seen poverty growing in the suburbs, it's still growing in urban areas, in rural communities. It's just that suburbs were home to the fastest pace of growth in the poor population. So between 2000 and 2014, the number of residents living below the federal poverty line in the suburbs grew by 65%. That's more than twice the pace of growth that we saw in big cities at that same time period.
Now, I did hear you cite rural regions as well. To what extent is this a factor in exurbs and rural parts of the country?
So rural communities have also seen the poor population grow in recent years, but at a much slower pace, and they make up a much smaller share of the nation's poor population. And in exurban communities, actually, we consider exurbs sort of part of the suburban landscape. So within major metro areas, our definition of suburbs encompasses both sort of older inner ring places that are right across the urban or city boundary, as well as those more outerlying bedroom communities sort of at the metropolitan fringe, but within the metro area, but just towards the outskirts. So even when we talk about suburbs, we're talking about a really diverse array of places, and we've seen this trend really reach across those different kinds of community types.
Certainly the recession of 2008-09 played a hand, but what are the other contributing factors to the growth of poverty in suburbs?
There are a number of different issues that have helped shape these trends over time. You know, the poor population in suburbs grew because more poor residents moved to the suburbs and because more residents in the suburbs became poor. So some of that, as you mentioned, is the impact of the recession, which really pushed fast forward on these trends. We've also seen structural changes in the economy, which have, you know, us making more and more low-wage jobs, jobs that even if you're working full-time wouldn't be enough to get a family above the poverty line. And those jobs, a lot of those jobs are in suburban communities. The bulk of workers who work in those jobs tend to live in suburban communities. There are also things like, where is affordable housing located within a region? You know, some older suburban communities have seen their housing stock age, become more affordable over time. Some regions are seeing housing price pressures in the city push people to look further out for affordable options. There are a number of different factors that together have helped really push up these numbers in recent years. I think one of the real challenges we've seen with the rapid growth in poverty in the suburbs is so many of the communities seeing some of the largest upticks lack infrastructure and safety net supports that many cities have built up over decades of grappling with these issues. So public transit may be less present to begin with, or it might be difficult to connect to safety net services as well as work, particularly because the suburban safety net tends to be much thinner and patchier than what we have in many major cities.
Under that umbrella of services and infrastructure, I imagine schools and education come to mind as well.
That's right. In many of these communities, schools are really on the front lines of these trends. You know, in our major metro areas, the free and reduced price lunch population has been growing at a faster pace in suburbs than in cities. And many of these school districts haven't seen sort of resources keeping pace with the rapid rise in need. And often, especially in the context of a weaker suburban safety net, you know, families may be coming to the schools saying, we're looking for help maybe for the first time and aren't sure where to find it. So we often have seen in our travels around the country and in conversations with places grappling with these trends, schools are often trying to find a way to bridge that gap in capacity by bringing in social safety net services, things like food pantries or clothing pantries, even medical or dental services, sort of trying to meet basic needs even before they get to the work of their education goals. And often, again, they're doing this in a really resource-constrained environment, trying to sort of play catch up to the level of need they're now experiencing.
Elizabeth, can we fold immigration into the conversation?
Yes, so that's been a piece of this trend over time as well. You know, increasingly, as we've seen immigrants move into major metropolitan areas, they are increasingly bypassing central cities altogether and moving directly to suburban communities. But as we think about it in context of the growth of suburban poverty, you know, the immigration contribution to population growth overall in the suburbs is much greater than it has been to the growth in the poor population. So, you know, overall, nationally, the poor population that's foreign-born only contributed about 17% of the growth in that rapid rise in the suburban poor population. So while that's it's a piece of the puzzle and it's an important one as we think about policy and the sort of nonprofit safety net and needs for cultural competency and outreach to that population, in reality, the growth that we've seen in the suburban poor population has been a largely native-born phenomenon.
Speak to the effort to reform and modernize, I suppose, the nation's policy toward alleviating poverty.
Not only have public perceptions lagged behind today's geography of poverty, but our policy framework from the federal level on down has often been slow to adapt or catch up. Where we're seeing a lot of innovation and leadership on these issues is among local and regional leaders working across jurisdictional boundaries, sort of collaborating and integrating across issue areas, you know, thinking about how housing links to transportation or education needs link to the safety net. And so really trying to take limited resources and stretch them further to help more people in more places.
In the course of your work, do specific communities or regions come to mind that might be perhaps in the vanguard of innovative approaches to tackling the situation?
Yes, we've seen regions like the Chicago metropolitan area or the Seattle metropolitan area, two very different places or two very different regions who are sort of leading on some of these models like I mentioned. So for instance, in the Chicago metropolitan area, that's a very fragmented region jurisdictionally. So when we talk about the suburbs there outside of the city of Chicago, we're talking about hundreds of communities who are grappling with these issues. And, you know, following the collapse of the housing market and the onset of the foreclosure crisis, some of the highest rates of foreclosure, some of the areas struggling with those rapid rises in needs in recent years were communities in South Cook County, so just south of the city of Chicago. And instead of sort of competing for limited resources, like many of these places are often set up to do, what happened is you had 19 suburban municipalities come together in the late 2000s to say, how do we address shared challenges around the foreclosure crisis, so housing blight and vacancies. And together they applied for the neighborhood stabilization funds that had come online from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, you know, really working together as a sort of sub-region to think about how they would deploy those sorts of funds to have the biggest impact and how they could save on the capacity and administrative resources necessary to implement those sort of programs by working together. Since that initial application, you know, now about 24 communities are working together and have continued to attract funds and resources to the area to work together on things like housing, transit-oriented development, and even thinking along the lines of economic development together. So I think that's one good example of the sort of the sub-regional, sort of multi-jurisdictional approaches to some of these challenges.
Citing Chicago and, in addition, Las Vegas and parts of South Florida readily come to mind, areas with foreclosure crises. But that wasn't as dramatically Philadelphia's story, even in the depths of recession, nor has Philadelphia climbed as high out of the recession. How would you analyze this region in terms of prioritizing its needs?
So while, I think what's been so striking about this trend over time is that it's really touching all different kinds of regions and communities. And even though the specific experience of these trends might be somewhat different, there are a lot of similar challenges that places are facing. So in the Philadelphia region, it wasn't immune to the shifts and the trends that have seen in recent years. Over the same time period that I mentioned before, the city of Philadelphia saw poverty grow, the poor population grow between 2000 and 2014. But the suburbs saw it grow at a much faster pace. So the urban portion of that was about a 17% increase in the poor population, whereas the suburbs, the poor population grew by more than half. And that's something that sort of that growth was happening even in advance of the downturn, particularly in the suburbs. So again, though the sort of the magnitude and perhaps the way this is playing out is somewhat different than a place like Las Vegas or some of the Sun Belt metro areas you mentioned, like Phoenix or the Florida metro areas, who are really hit hard by the housing crisis. The Philadelphia region is still grappling with some of those same issues that come along with dealing with a more regional reach of poverty, and especially as poverty is growing, perhaps in places where it may have previously seen immune, or it might be more of a hidden issue. And therefore, that also raises some challenges as we think about how to update our response to poverty and addressing poverty in place is really updating understandings of where that poor population lives and who all is being affected by this issue.
We are, of course, immersed in, what shall we call it, a boisterous presidential campaign. And when the candidates discuss the issues, I'm not sure I've heard them speak much specifically to poverty. Yes, bolstering the middle class, but again, cycling back to the war on poverty declared by then-President Johnson in 1964, is it really even on the radar at that level?
You don't really hear the word poverty very much. You hear sort of related concepts or things about the middle class or inequality. You know, interestingly, in January, Speaker Ryan hosted a conversation among Republican presidential candidates about poverty. He's himself put forward a sort of poverty plan in recent years, and trying to sort of elevate that conversation on the right. I think on the left, and in terms of the Democrats, there are more policies you see within their platforms that do target the low-income population, whether or not it's couched as actually addressing poverty. There are a number of policies directed in that direction. But I think what's really missing, not beyond just the explicit discussion of poverty, is across what conversations are taking place and what policies we are seeing proposed, is the real understanding and discussion of how place matters, that these really aren't things that just operate on a national level or even at the state level, that where you live makes a difference, and how we think about approaching this issue from a place perspective really matters, that we need to be conscious of how places intersect with these issues and can shape responses so that they can be more effective in the long run.
Elizabeth, in describing poverty in America, do you see this as a trend that's continuing to grow, stabilizing, perhaps improving?
Since the war on poverty, we now have the largest number of people living below the federal poverty line. Even though the recession ended in 2009, we're several years into economic recovery. We really haven't seen much progress in this post-recession period in bringing poverty down. And that's true across cities and suburbs. I think one thing that this is really pointing to is how unshared this recovery has been. It really hasn't reached down the economic ladder to bring relief to people at the lower end of the income scale.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for sharing perspective on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.